Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 10th, 2012. Today on the show, we continue our look at religion and money, and we find that the Mormon Church is quite invested in personal finance.
The church counsels us to be prudent, to be careful, not to overspend, not to get in debt, and a lot of that has to do, I think, with a sense of freedom. So whether you're talking about religious freedom or in this case financial freedom.
I don't think that we're pro-money or anti-money. It's just that money is a useful tool and it's to enable other things that are way more important than money.
And these days there are plenty of alternatives to owning a home. You can buy one with friends or you could build your own place.
Another thing that I tried to do is just limit the what I call the I wannas. Which is, you know, I want a jacuzzi tub, I want an exercise room, I want a four-car garage.
Those stories plus the fiscal cliff coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
So the average price of a four-year college has more than doubled in the last 30 years. That is what the College Board tells us. And in part because of that, the average student graduates with around $25,000 in student loan debt. Now, all of this is becoming a pretty familiar story, but what's often missing from the discussion is why. Why is the price of higher education rising so much faster than even healthcare? From the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott has been looking into that part of the discussion, and she joins us now. Hello.
Hi, Tess.
So you had a story on Marketplace a couple of weeks ago featuring a, shall we say, lavish campus fitness center. Let's play a clip from that.
This first pool is called our leisure pool. It's got zero entry. There's a vortex that the water swirls around. There's a whirlpool.
Okay, I want to go there.
Do you know what zero entry is?
No, but why not?
It's fancy. Yeah. We'll just say that. So yeah, that is Tom Deal, who is director of recreational sports at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. Mm. And he was describing one of the pools in the college's new $46 million fitness center.
$46 million.
Yeah. It is, and lavish is a good word. I've never seen anything like this. It's an old open-air marketplace that's been converted, and it's got, you know, soaring ceilings and hundreds of pieces of cardiovascular equipment. And the centerpiece is this 40-foot climbing wall. I actually climbed it, I must say. These things are popping up on campuses everywhere, and they've become kind of a symbol of the rising price of college. And so I sort of wanted to fact check that a little bit and see how much that really is driving costs.
And what did you find out?
Well, in VCU's case, it's increased costs about $100 per student.
Well, that doesn't sound like much.
Yeah, I mean, the university borrowed a lot of money to pay for this, but with 30,000 students, it doesn't have to raise fees by that much to pay that back over time. But experts say that there, you know, there's no doubt this campus building boom we've been seeing does play a role in higher prices, particularly when schools take on a lot of debt to pay for it. I talked to one guy who tracks facility spending, Jim Kadamis, with a company called Sightlines. And he says a lot of the spending is to replace aging buildings. So it really has to happen. And roughly half of what he's seen is actually for academic buildings, you know, the state-of-the-art science labs and the like.
Less than 15% of the space, new space, was in student life buildings, which would include student centers, recreation, gymnasiums, those types of buildings. That's still a significant amount of spending, but it's a lot less than I think people would think.
Well, perhaps that is the case, Amy, but if it's not rock climbing walls and fancy pools that are making college so expensive these days, what is it?
Well, for state schools, and that's where most college students go, the biggest factor by far is the decline in state funding for higher ed. Just last year, states cut roughly $6 billion in funding. And schools like VCU are trying to make some of that up by raising tuition. And in fact, the same year the gym opened, tuition and fees went up 24%. Hmm. you know, I think it's fair to say it wasn't because of the climbing wall. Right. It was because of that lost state and federal funding. But there are some other reasons, if you want to hear them.
Sure.
I'm just going to sort of run off a list of the common factors that are cited. The cost of providing benefits to faculty. You know, everyone's paying more for health care.
Right.
That's no different at colleges. A big one is the cost of providing financial aid to students who can't afford full price. So that's sort of ironic. And also, a lot of people believe that the availability of loans and federal funding have allowed colleges to get away with charging higher prices because families have this flow of money to help them pay for it. And there's even sort of a disincentive to lower prices because there's a sense that if a college charges a lot, it must be good.
Right, right. Even if all these high-end fancy facilities on campus aren't adding that much to the cost of college, are they really necessary? I mean, you know, couldn't they be kind of giving a skewed view of what life after college is going to be like? Because you're not probably going to have a fancy climbing wall and a fancy pool.
Well, you probably, like me, shared a room with a roommate and had to walk down the hall to the bathroom. I mean, the way students are living these days is really different. You know, they have shared suites with their own private bathroom, and they're eating sushi and steak in their cafeterias. And I think for a lot of us, it's easy to wonder if students aren't getting a little spoiled.
Right.
But, you know, the colleges are telling me at the prices these students are paying, a lot of them feel like, you know, they better get a lot from their money. And officials tell me they really have to build these things if they're going to compete.
Well, that just sounds like a massive vicious cycle, because you have kids who are expecting all kinds of fancy stuff in order to get what they're paying for. And then colleges are charging more because people are expecting all this fancy stuff.
Right. And one listener actually wrote in and said, it sounds like it's a symptom of the problem rather than the cause. Hmm. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that is pretty accurate.
Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us from Baltimore. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I've gotten used to Chicken Littles running around and shouting about stuff. U.S. government debt downgrades, debt ceiling debates. Well, and this time it is the so-called fiscal cliff. The tax breaks President George W. Bush authorized are set to expire at the end of the year, and at the same time, some deep federal spending cuts are kicking in. It's all several months away, but pundits are already panicking about what could happen to the economy. So let's hear what it might mean for you and me. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Here's the very latest. In recent days, some lawmakers have taken the first steps to avert such a disaster. Tax planning expert Greg Rossica has been watching this play out for the accounting firm Ernst & Young.
We're dealing with bills being introduced this week to try to get various extensions in place. And so, you know, then you start to think, well, there's a chance that it won't be the way it's scheduled to be January 1st, but it may be something yet different and in between, perhaps.
Congress is notorious for pushing tax decisions to the last minute, so Rossica says you should be thinking through what adjustments you might have to make to your lifestyle. Tax expert Kay Bell at Bankrate.com says the first hit would rattle most everyone. Americans now pay just 10% on the first $17,000 earned, but that's set to automatically go back up to 15% with progressively higher rates the more you make, and you won't have to wait until tax filing time to feel the pain.
When the tax rates expire at the end of this year, that would be immediate, first paycheck that people got in 2013 with the new higher rates.
Based on the taxes withheld by your employer, which means, Bell suggests, there will be two fiscal cliffs. Many taxpayers could encounter more trouble the following year when tax returns come due because a whole host of deductions and credits could be gone.
A lot of the things they probably would not be aware of until they went to fill out their 1040s and went, whoa, what happened to that tax break?
One of the deductions set to be reduced has long provided relief from the so-called marriage penalty. Bell says Congress adjusted the amount of taxed income to keep married couples from having to pay higher rates when they file jointly, and that relief would disappear.
So when that goes away, that could cause those married couples to end up paying a bit more tax.
Parents have been able to take a big credit right off the top for each child, but Bell says that's set to be cut in half.
The child tax credit is now $1,000 per qualifying child. If the Bush tax cuts expire, it will go down to $500 per child.
The list of looming tax changes goes on, including some that aren't part of the so-called Bush tax cuts. Ernst & Young's Greg Rossica says you'd be wise to look into which ones apply to you so you can be quick to respond.
If you you're looking at a change, for example, in the taxes on dividends, and you have very significant dividends, you know, then you might look to whether there's different types of investment or different types of income that you ought to, you know, arrange your financial affairs to generate.
All this uncertainty is already making Americans less confident about spending, and Bankrate's Kay Bell fears holiday sales could slump if Congress hasn't decided by then.
People can't plan their own personal finances and taxes. This fiscal cliff is as much psychological as it is actual economic concern. We're all just watching Congress juggle these things and worrying which balls they're going to drop.
Ultimately, experts say what happens will come down to a key body of other decision makers, American voters, when they choose which direction they want the country to go. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
In addition to the whole fiscal cliff mess, seems like every other week or so we hear about some new scandal on Wall Street, from LIBOR to that trading firm that caused wild swings on the Dow one recent morning. Commentator Chris Farrell says a lost piece of regulation could restore investor confidence.
Is our financial system any safer than it was in 2008? The J.P. Morgan multi-billion dollar London whale trading debacle and the rigging of the LIBOR market by traders suggests not. Big financial institutions are bigger than ever, and every bit as reckless and dangerous as before. We need to rein in these too-big-to-fail behemoths before they take down the economy again. Step one is to put the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 out of its misery. The act is more than 2,300 pages, and it's complicated, weak, compromised, and riddled with loopholes. Step two is to immediately replace the bill with the Glass-Steagall Act. It was written in 1933, and it's just 37 pages long. It separated banks that accepted deposits backed by the FDIC from investment banks. It blocked Wall Street traders from speculating in the capital market casino with government-insured money. Glass-Steagall worked for some 60 years until it was repealed in 1999. It's simple. It's pro-competition and pro-capitalism. Best of all, if it was restored, it would slash the odds of another taxpayer-funded bailout. Paul Volcker, the legendary former Fed chairman, is a fan. He wanted to bring Glass-Steagall back after the global financial crisis. The administration and Congress ignored him. But now the law is winning support for some unlikely quarters. Sandy Weill was a hyper-aggressive dealmaker who built Citigroup into a megabank. He pushed hard for the repeal of Glass-Steagall, but now he supports its return. So, step three is to put Volcker in charge of making the dream of a new Glass-Steagall Act a reality. 3 decades ago, Volcker broke the back of inflation, refusing to bend in his mission despite fierce opposition. Unleash the tough-minded Volcker on the big banks. He's exactly what the American taxpayer needs.
Chris Farrell is the Marketplace Economics Editor. Last week, we began a series of conversations about the role religion plays in some families' financial decisions. We started with an exploration of how Muslims view money management. Today, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I'm set, I think. Silverware I do not have.
Earlier this year, on a trip to Park City, Utah, I sat down to dinner with several members of the Mormon Church. Greg Robinson is a vice president and wealth advisor with Wells Fargo. He's also a nephew of Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. His wife, Robin, is an author and educator. Greg Bishop, yes, we have two Gregs here, serves as general counsel for a home automation company in Salt Lake City. His wife, Christy, is a massage therapist. And finally, a familiar voice on this program, financial advisor and napkin artist Carl Richards of Buckingham Asset Management. I started by asking the group where Mormonism fits into how they approach money.
Greg Robinson speaking. My faith informs the way I think about money completely. We're encouraged by our faith and by the teachings of our faith regarding provident living, as we describe it, is that we should live within our means, that we should be paying a full tithing, recognize that all of our material well-being as well as our spiritual well-being comes from God, and that we should be, you know, putting first things first and thinking much more about family and providing for our family and our children and enabling good things to happen in the world as opposed to just enriching ourselves.
You said the word provident living?
Provident living. Mm-hmm.
It's just a term that's used to describe wise, careful choices, planning for the future, thinking about resources, thinking carefully about the things that you do with what you've been blessed with.
That was Robin.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Greg. So Mormons or Latter-day Saints are often known for their practice of keeping food in reserve and those kinds of things. That's part of the provident living that we're talking about. So having money set aside, having food set aside, having clothing and gasoline or whatever you might need for a rainy day.
Sounds like debt is really something that is antithetical to that.
Yes, but also the church as an entity recognizes that there are certain situations where debt is a useful tool, but it's to be used with caution. Mm-hmm. For example, education, buying a home, you know, large purchases. But generally speaking, it's wise to avoid it. Of course, because this is Robin, by the way. You get into debt and you no longer are free to have the range of choices that you would have had were you not in debt. You know, it limits your ability to act independently because if you owe someone, you are, in a sense, their slave to a certain degree because you have to make that monthly payment or whatever. So it limits your options.
This is Greg Bishop. I think Robin's right. I think the church counsels us to be prudent, to be careful, not to overspend, not to get in debt. And a lot of that has to do, I think, with a sense of freedom. So whether you're talking about religious freedom or in this case financial freedom, that's a big thing for us as members of the church.
That sounds very common, I would think, though, to many, if not most, faiths. Is there anything within the Mormon faith that you think is in some way different, a teaching, an emphasis that you would not necessarily see in Catholicism or Buddhism or what have you?
This is Robin again. I think that phrase, provident living, is somewhat singular because that planning for the future, there is a heavy emphasis on that. Not just to use your resources wisely, not just to be careful with money, because I think that is pretty universal, but I think to actively plan for a rainy day, to set food and fuel resources aside. And, you know, some people see that as hoarding, but I see it as very freeing because if you have those resources set aside when times are scarce, then the limited resources are then available for others. You don't have to tap into that.
Well, then is it fair in a very generalized way to say that members of the Mormon faith are probably better savers?
We want to be.
We should be.
We should be.
This is Christy. I know all churches serve, but I think a lot of members of the Mormon church, we are taught that you help others, whether it be financially, whether it physically, in whatever form that you can. You go and you serve other people. And if you yourself are not in a good place, you're not able to go help other people. So for me, that's a huge part of being financially responsible. So you're in a good spot yourself, so you can reach out and help others.
And this is Carl. I think that the church is very careful to look for ways to help, sort of that old saying of giving a hand up instead of a hand out. And I think it's really interesting to think about, like, look, the first line of defense is personal, and then who in your family could help you? You know, when you need help and you go to, like, a local, we refer to as a bishop, a local leader, almost universally the first question is there anybody in your family that can help? Once we've exhausted the resources of the family, then maybe the church can help. But it's this idea of being independent.
But in that case, what about those who do not have those resources and don't have the ability to save for the rainy day or to save to help others? What does the church say about them?
I think there's two answers to that question.
This is Robin.
First of all, we're encouraged to work, to engage in meaningful labor. Productivity is important just for the sense of self-esteem and the rewards that that brings. But within that context, we are encouraged to pay a 10% tithe, no matter how small our income is. And of course, there's a spiritual, not just spiritual, but there is a spiritual sort of guarantee that you obtain from that, where if you are obedient, then you receive a blessing. And so even if you don't make a lot of money, If you are donating that 10%, which is what the Lord has asked of us, then you have the Lord's promise that he will help you when times are difficult. And the second part is that the church organized what's called the Perpetual Education Fund. Basically, what it is that people in the church who have means donate to this fund, and it is specifically intended to help those who don't have as much money to obtain an education so that they can rise in whatever their circumstances are so that they can improve and better themselves, their lives, their families.
And then there's a payback mechanism, right? If I
yes.
understand it right, so that after you get your education and now you're earning more money than you would have been uneducated, then you pay back the loan that came from the fund to begin with, and it just keeps going forward.
And that was Greg Bishop.
Yeah, that was Greg Bishop, Ms. Greg Robinson. So there's a huge emphasis in the church on education. That's one of the things that we haven't mentioned, but that's connected to this financial independence, is that we're encouraged to seek as much education as we can get, because we recognize that as you are more and more educated, then your income earning potential increases, your independence and self-reliance increases. And so for those who wouldn't be able to seek that education without financial assistance, the church has that fund.
I want to pick up on something that Robin said, which is, I think you used the phrase spiritual guarantee that you obtain from tithing. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about tithing a little bit because it's been in the news because of our current presidential candidate. And certainly other faiths have tithing.
Yeah.
But how does that fit into the family budget and into how you plan your spending and saving? Because 10% is not insignificant.
This is Greg Bishop. For me, it's a paradigm, right? So if you start from the position that all of this that I earn is mine, then you say to yourself, wow, 10%, that's a lot that I'm giving away. But if your paradigm is everything that I have comes from God, so I earned it, yes, but the abilities that I have, my education, my ability to do labor or whatever it is, the way that you earn your money, if that all comes from God because he allows you to live and breathe and exist, then 10% back is just, that's just the piece that he wants back of stuff that was his to begin with.
And this is Greg Robinson. And there are other ways that you can give to the church, such as fast offerings. So once a month, we fast for 24 hours, and we are encouraged to take the money that we would have spent on that food, and we give it to the poor. So the welfare assistance to the poor, the humanitarian aid, that does not come from tithing funds. Tithing funds go to building chapels, churches, temples, running the church universities, running the church. So that's what we give in addition to the 10%. And we're encouraged to pay a generous fast offering.
And most active members, this is Robin, I think most active members do. They give the tithing and they give the additional. It's just common practice.
This is Carl. And I think this brings up another issue, this idea of give and you are blessed. Mm-hmm. There's a more complex piece of this conversation, which is we don't really know. It's not a you give and you're automatically blessed. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you can see an absolute direct correlation. And there's plenty of stories in my own life, and I'm sure we all have stories like that. But I think there is a tendency sometimes culturally for us to get stuck in that trap of using money as a comparison. And maybe that there's some correlation to our own personal righteousness or worthiness. And I think we have to be very careful. In fact, I know we have to be very careful there. It's particularly of sort of judgment of, you know, when somebody's going through tough financial situation, does that necessarily mean they did something wrong on the other end? No, mm-hmm. we don't know how all that works out.
Well, and if they're in that tough financial situation, what if they can't tithe?
That's a slightly different question. I don't know that you get in a situation where you can't tithe, right? I mean, if you're earning an income and, you know, you pay your tithing. Many of us have been in a situation where we didn't know where the money was going to come to pay for a bill 5 days later if we wrote that check, and it worked out.
But certainly there are people for whom that has not worked out.
Absolutely. The wonderful thing I think about the Mormon church is none of us in this room and most of us in the church aren't in a position to be placing judgment on anybody else's situation. We're there to love and help and encourage.
This is Greg Robinson. The opportunity to tithe, though, is for everyone. So even for little children, I mean, if they get $10 for their birthday, they can pay $1 of tithing to God. So that the idea of giving tithing is not related at all to the amount It's much more this recognition, this paradigm of everything I have comes from God, and he's going to watch out for me, and he's going to make sure that we're taken care of one way or another.
Carl, again, and being taken care of doesn't necessarily mean financially. I mean, there are plenty of examples of people who did everything right and things didn't work out financially, you know, but being taken care of means it's the same with the term rich, right? What does that word mean, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily mean a bunch of money. And I think paying tithing is also not necessarily about getting something back, right? That's not, we're not doing that. I hesitate to even use the word investment.
No, it's an expression of faith.
Yeah, I mean, it's just what you do.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you don't pay tithing because you have money. You pay tithing because you have faith. So it's just as hard for somebody who's poor to pay 10% as it is for somebody who's rich to pay that big dollar value. It sounds a little... No, I really think it is. I mean, when you get to some very large numbers, you're like, wow, that's, you know, I could do some other things with this. It's an expression of faith either way. And even the poorest can exercise their faith by paying tithing.
Carl brought up the question of wealth and definitions thereof are, they'll run the gamut, you know, depending who you're talking to. But I wonder, is there anything specific in the Book of Mormon that talks about wealth?
Oh, yeah.
You know, what it means to be rich, what the definition of that.
Mostly, from my perspective, this is Robin, from my perspective, the Book of Mormon is cautionary against, it's not the money that's bad, but it's having your heart dwelling on the money.
Set.
It's the things that money can buy. It's the idols. It's what Isaiah talks about, you know, the false idols. The Book of Mormon is very much in that exact vein. Same thing. Don't set your heart upon the things of this world. It's service, it's charity, it's faith, it's those important intangibles. And so the money is just a means to live on this earth, to exist, and to enable you to achieve the things that are of most eternal significance. The money is secondary.
And yet at the same time, you know, based on your description earlier, part of what you try to do on a daily basis is have some sort of accumulation that will keep you safe and then also allow you to bolster others if you need to. So on one hand, it seems that there's this need to accumulate. And on the other hand, perhaps then, you know, the Book of Mormon is telling you, but don't let that enter your head.
Yeah.
Don't let it canker your soul.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if your God becomes money, then you've really lost the important thing, right? So, yeah, it's important to be self-reliant, take care of your family, your extended family. But if at the end of all of that, your money and your possessions take your full attention, then you've missed the point of why you're here to begin with. It's not about collecting money. It's about getting yourself to be more like God and returning to him in that better condition. It's like Steve Covey said, you know, people spend their whole life climbing up the ladder only to realize it's leaning against the wrong wall, right? So you spend all that time trying to climb the ladder of success. It's rare somebody on their deathbed says, gee, I wish I would have spent, you know, I would have had more money in my bank account. I wish I would have spent more time at the office. Which goes back to sort of the core Mormon value, family first. So all of those monetary things are great, but it's all about love and service and family, really.
Does God want you to be rich?
Yeah, I don't think that we're pro-money or anti-money. Either one. I don't think that's really part of the equation. It's not like we're anti-rich or anti-poverty. It's just that money is a useful tool. And it's to enable other things that are way more important than money.
And this is Carl. I think that's one of the challenge of our time, at least among certain communities, is can we figure out how to make it just a useful tool and nothing more?
You can't get your self-worth from money.
That's Greg Bishop.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you have to be the kind of person that God wants you to be, independent of whether you're poor or rich, because money's a false way of measuring yourself. You can have a lot of money, and just like that, it can be gone. And that doesn't mean you're a worse person because you lost your money, and it doesn't mean you're a better person because you got your money, right? It's all about the kind of person that you're supposed to be and focusing on sort of the core values of the church. It's not about collecting stuff.
Greg Robinson, and I think the balance that we need to try and find as a nation, and certainly that we're encouraged to try and find it within our own faith in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is it stems from discipline. You know, the word disciple, to be a disciple of Christ, is to be disciplined in the way we live. And so whether we have a little or a lot financially, it's you're living in the same patterns and in the same way.
I do have one additional thought in answer specifically to your question. This is Robin again. And that is that I don't know, I've been sitting here thinking about this, I don't know that there's anything unique to the Latter-day Saint faith about money per se, a unique teaching. But I do think that when you're not in debt, you do feel freer. And when you don't have the complications of overspending or focusing on greed or the pride that material things can bring you, that simplifies your life and clarifies your vision. So I think those kinds of things are very helpful, not just for the Latter-day Saints, but for people of all faiths.
Robin and Greg Robinson, Greg and Christy Bishop and Carl Richards, thank you all for talking with us about this.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
And in a couple of weeks, we'll continue our discussions of money teachings, and we'll be reviewing the Jewish and Catholic faiths. So join us for that. And before we leave the subject, a correction, thanks to some sharp-eared listeners last week. I introduced this segment by asking whether money is the root of all evil. Well, the correct quote from 1 Timothy 6:10 reads, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil." Back to Sunday school for me. So here's something nobody ever really wants to talk about, despite the fact that more than half of marriages end in it. Yes, we're going to address the financial issues around divorce. If you've got advice or tips or stories to tell, we'd love to hear them. We'd also like to know what questions you have about this touchy subject. You can reach us on Facebook, on Twitter, or at marketplace.org. No prenup required.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
I'm happy to report that I have some very, very close friends. Vacation with them, have them over for parties, share life's finer moments with them, and the not-so-fine ones. But would I make one of the biggest investments of my life with them? I'm not so sure. Anne Hepperman has the story of friends in New York who decided to take the plunge and become friends indeed.
Four friends are sitting in a restaurant in Brooklyn, and they're having dinner to celebrate a big purchase.
So we all just bought a house.
Glad that we did this together.
Yeah.
To four brains.
Four brains are better than one.
Ah, but did you catch that?
To four brains.
Four brains are better than one.
That's right. These four friends, two married couples actually, Aaron Siegel and Zoe Singer, and Sarah Kornbluth and Dan Friel just bought a house together in Brooklyn.
I don't feel the remorse yet.
To it never coming.
But the idea of living together was actually hatched years ago on a park bench in New York City, kind of like the one we're at today.
I remember that we used to knit, too. Do you remember knitting on a park bench?
Oh, yeah. Zoe Singer's reminding her best friend, Sarah Kornbluth, about how the two would hang out and talk about growing old together.
Yeah, lots of plans about aging.
We look forward to getting old.
Zoe and Sarah have been BFFs for more than 30 years, and they're adorable.
We share a brain.
It's a good one.
They grew up in Brooklyn just blocks apart.
Hello,
they'd fall asleep talking on the phone, and then in the morning wake up and start talking again. They shared everything.
Yeah, so we shared a boyfriend. I mean, we didn't share him. We each took a turn with him.
So sharing a house doesn't seem like a stretch.
No.
I know, it sounds crazy. But some housing experts say collective home ownership is not totally insane. And here's why. Mortgage rates are at an all-time low. Rents continue to rise. And banks, well, if you haven't heard the news, they're not handing out many loans these days. So to get the home you want in the neighborhood you want to live in, pooling financial resources can actually make sense, especially for friends like Sarah and Zoe, who live in what's called a hot housing market. Think shockingly expensive.
So yeah, we'd be like, wow, there's like a beautiful four-floor property on 6th Avenue and I don't know what it was, like 6th Street. Let's live there. And then we'd look at the listing and be like, whoa.
Oh, man, I don't have $2 million.
Over the years, Sarah and Zoe talked a lot about how frustrating looking for a home could be. Zoe says especially when she realized that being approved for a $500,000 loan actually didn't get much.
We started looking at houses and realizing like nobody that we knew could afford their own house. We could afford half of a house.
Sarah and her husband had the same problem.
I was talking to Dan about how disappointed I was that we wouldn't be able to afford more than an apartment. Unless, you know.
So they decided to get serious about their dream. The four friends then went down to the bank, and as a group, they were pre-approved for more than $1 million.
It all of a sudden got real.
That's true. It got real really fast.
Okay.
And it opened up a lot of options. But buying a home is a personal thing. In a lot of ways, it's just as much of an emotional decision as it is a financial one. Sarah's husband Dan says he felt that way when the four of them would go to open houses together.
Both couples would go and look at a single house, sometimes a pretty small house, and try and figure out how we would all live together and how we would divide it up and get what everyone wanted. That produced a lot of anxiety, a little bit of claustrophobia.
And Zoe and Aaron have this warning. If you plan to co-buy, brace yourself for some opinions.
It's also the kind of thing that, like, your parents are like, oh, God, no. Like,
they might be your friends now, but they won't be later.
Everyone's parents are supportive now. All it took was one look at Brooklyn's real estate prices, and the couples did find a home.
This place is like labyrinthine.
Two homes, actually, which is where we are today. Aaron and Zoe and Sarah and Dan are doing a final walkthrough. It's an odd property. One house is in the front, and another house is in the back, where the yard usually is.
Hey, Dan. What do you think about this missing paint here?
But it's near the neighborhood where Sarah and Zoe grew up. And Wells Fargo approved them for a $1.3 million 30-year mortgage at 4%. So they're able to gut renovate and build their dream homes.
This is going
to
be the sauna, right? Right here?
You're going to have a sauna?
Yeah. You want to come?
Yes!
The couples admit there were a lot of ups and downs to get here. For one thing, consensus among four people can take a long time.
What do you think? Should we still buy the house?
Closing a house usually takes weeks. But for the two couples, it took more than 7 months.
I said, let's buy this place.
Let's do it.
But buying a home together also made them more prepared than your average home buyer. The group had a lawyer draw up a 48-page contract that outlines all kinds of what-if scenarios.
Okay, what happens if one of you dies?
What happens if someone wants to sell?
And even questions like, who's responsible for this area of concrete?
And then, of course, they had to be really upfront about money.
We got to know each other's finances very well, more than anyone, I think, anyone I know.
So how much do you have in yours?
No, I have to ask at the bank.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it's this much.
Which Aaron said made him realize that when you buy a home with friends, you're taking on more than just a mortgage.
The things that are the scariest are like, what if one of the couples gets divorced? And there's some kind of big to-do about, like, how the property is governed or how it's split up or it's resold. That's a pretty scary thing. But in a way, also, it's like, that's something that everyone who's married probably is worrying about at some point in their relationship. Like, is this going to last? How long is this going to last?
We just doubled our chances.
Yeah.
Having to worry about that.
But in the end, both couples said they found comfort in doing this together. Buying a house is daunting. Risky, even. So why not take the plunge with your best friend?
Zoe.
I'm a homeowner.
Me too.
In New York, I'm Ann Hepperman for Marketplace.
This is such a crazy thing.
Despite the gauntlet you have to run to get a mortgage these days, when it comes to homeownership, where there's a will, there is often a way. Our next guest, Jana Cooper, took the path to owning a house that's often reserved for people with time and money to burn. She built her own just south of the 10 freeway here in the heart of L.A. Dwell Magazine featured her home in their August issue. It's three stories with a roof deck and a modern minimalist facade. And she did it on a budget and with a deadline. She also just happens to be an architect. Jana Cooper, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So do you have to be a licensed architect to figure this process out, or can the rest of us do what you did?
I think having knowledge of the industry certainly helps, but I don't think it's something that's completely unachievable for someone that's willing to spend some time doing some research and a little homework.
So you built your house on a budget of $200 per square foot. That is pretty darn low. How did your budget affect your design and construction?
Well, I looked at the budget constraints as just another one of the challenges along the way of the project and sort of use that in informing the design. So my concept was basically to take ordinary standard materials and use them in a way that's compelling and interesting. So taking ordinary corrugated sheet metal and stucco and putting them together in a way that's compelling. And another thing that I tried to do was just limit the what I call the I wantas, which is, you know, I want a jacuzzi tub, I want an exercise room, I want a four-car garage. So you just kind of have to keep watch on those and only allow yourself to have what you need.
Right, which is the case whether you're building your own house or not.
Yeah. And as far as construction goes, I just tried to get competitive bids from lots of subcontractors and talk to them along the way about value engineering and let them know that the drawings basically represent what it is that I want to do and my idea of how to do it. But if they have an idea of how to do it less expensive, then I'm definitely willing to discuss options. So just be open to the expertise that they have, and but, you know, not completely relying on it.
Well, you also saved a lot of money by acting as your own general contractor. What did that entail in terms of the job for you?
The biggest aspect, I think, of being your own contractor is the sequencing. It's really absolutely critical to understand what happens first before something else can happen. And it's a lot of it was just asking questions, you know, talk to the electrician. Okay, electrician, what do you need to have happen before you come put in the rough electrical? And he'll let you know, okay, well, I need two floors of framing and then all the plumbing should go in first and then I can come in and it'll take me about 2 days. And so then you figure after that, okay, you know, just think sort of thinking it through in advance.
Well, one of your cost saving devices was, it sounds so obvious, but you just simply asked people for discounts just by saying, hey, can you find a way for this to be less money for me?
I think with discounts, it's, you know, ask and you shall receive. I don't see anything wrong with, you know, asking someone if you could maybe get a discount on it. And they're, of course, free to say no. It's a business transaction, so both sides should be happy. You know, all my plumbing fixtures, I got discounts on those. I started with the internet and looked at discount plumbing websites, asking if they had any specials or coupon codes to type in. And, you know, even went so far as to call the place and ask them, you know, hey, if I get all my sinks and toilets here, would you give me another discount? So, and usually people were very willing.
So you went into this wanting to build your dream house. Are you having good dreams there? Are you loving it?
Yeah, I absolutely love it. It's really fun to live in a place that that you've designed sort of for your own needs and desires, and it's a nice place to come home to.
Jana Cooper is an architect here in Los Angeles. She chronicled the building of her home in this month's issue of Dwell magazine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So we've talked about going in on a home purchase with friends and building one for yourself. Now let's hear how the housing market is doing in one hard-hit city, Atlanta. Low prices and mortgage interest rates should be prompting people to buy. But as Jim Burris reports from WABE in Atlanta, many young people say they are simply not interested.
These are three stories from young people, all making decisions on how they fit into this weird, unpredictable, and chronically depressed housing market that now defines Atlanta.
I am Mary Hinkle. I am 23 years old.
Mary grew up near Cleveland, Ohio. She says she never traveled farther than one state away. After high school, she wanted adventure. Mary convinced herself she'd find it at Agnes Scott College, an all-women's liberal arts school.
The hallway, small, clearly used to be the hallway for an upstairs half of a house.
Mary lives in a large old house across from her old college. It's chopped into several small apartments. The rent's cheap. She and a roommate each pay $300 a month. Mary calls it a practical decision.
You know, I read all these doom and gloom things in the news about how people are still losing their jobs and their houses and how, like, 50% of people my age are unemployed or underemployed, and I worry, like, could it be me next? So
I ask her that cliche question about home ownership and the American dream, how what she just told me fits into her version.
I'm going to need to think about that one for a moment.
Take your time.
It takes Mary 1 minute and 2 seconds to come up with an answer. Her American dream includes her cats, a career in astronomy, a garden, and a large front porch.
But my version of the American dream isn't specifically tied to owning a piece of property that I stay in every single day. I could easily see myself renting an apartment for the rest of my life.
A lot of people see no problem with that.
John Wiley is a real estate professor at Georgia State. He says a decade ago, you'd never hear young people say they wanted to rent forever. But now, 20-somethings like Mary Hinkle know more bust than boom when it comes to housing prices. And that affects their view of home ownership, he says. But once you reach folks in their early 30s, they tend to still remember the good times. Many are willing to commit if the price is right, like Kim Karras and her partner Dean Alam.
This is probably as big as my first apartment, this master bedroom.
The couple has lived in Atlanta for more than a decade. Like all Atlantans, Kim and Dee heard of insane deals on foreclosures and short sales. Dee says they had no plans to buy, but a realtor friend suggested they at least look. Then they stumbled upon this foreclosure.
Because it was like, boom. The moment we walked into this house, we were like, oh my God, no, this isn't happening.
Yeah, and I think it was a different feeling too, because when we walked in, it was like, and we can do this, and this is this price? I mean, we, in our wildest dreams, never thought that this is something we could afford.
And by most standards, they shouldn't have been able to afford this house. Built new in 2008, it sold for $395,000. Because it was a foreclosure, they scooped it up for
$199,000.
That's $199,000, half what it sold for just a few years ago.
Atlanta is a very affordable market at this point.
Again, Georgia State real estate professor John Wiley.
And so that's one of the things that influences someone to buy is, can I afford it?
How affordable is affordable? Wiley says the median home price nationwide is about $165,000. Here, it's half that. And when it comes to condos,
the median condo price in Atlanta is $54,000. And this makes Atlanta, of all the 55 metropolitan areas that's tracked, it makes it the absolute lowest of all 55.
Like many big cities around the country, Atlanta's real estate market is showing signs of life. Jason Royal shows off the view from the 15th-story balcony of the condo he's about to buy.
You have Stone Mountain that way. You have Piedmont Park right here. So it's like my new backyard. And then you have the whole Atlanta skyline. And I don't know. It's just there's a whole lot going on around here.
This view is one reason the 25-year-old bought here. At $130,000, this 700-square-foot studio is well above Atlanta's market average. But it would cost him more to rent in this neighborhood than to buy. Ultimately, his choice to purchase came down to a blend of practicality and emotion.
Throughout this process, I've thought, when I'm old and gray, would I regret not taking this opportunity? And then I kept on thinking, yes, I want to live here. I want to wake up and see these views. I want to be able to walk out and go to the park. If I do not move here, I'll regret it.
Jason's not alone. In some Atlanta neighborhoods, buyers are bidding against each other for desirable properties. Inventory is dwindling, and the Case-Shiller Home Price Index shows 3 months of consecutive growth. Tiny growth, but any growth here is welcome. It appears Atlanta's housing crisis may have finally bottomed out, and that might be just enough to entice young buyers to dive in while prices are still cheap. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Hey, And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, one man's journey to financial recovery 7 years after Hurricane Katrina.
Financially, when the storm hit, no, I wasn't prepared. I don't think anyone was. The life of a musician is not easy. And the truth of the matter is I really didn't know what was going to happen next.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.